I need to acknowledge my cohorts in crime here. Chip Elliott is in the audience and will handle the questions, and Bob Bastian of EPA is back in Washington waiting to serve you should you need anything. From a distance, the earth appears to be literally awash with water and well deserving of its title as the blue planet. As we know, however, the devil is often in the details. And if we consider that water supply, we know that about 97.5% of it is saline, and a good portion of the fresh water is tied up in forms that is inaccessible to us, so that we're left to deal with only about less than 1% of all fresh water resources and only about 0.02% of all that water that we saw. Furthermore, the water isn't well distributed, at least not where people want to live. This is a map of various water basins indicating water scarcity as projected for 2025. And what it shows is that in most of the areas where there will be the mega population centers, more than 10 million people, that those water basins are either physically scarce in water, don't have much water, or there's economic water scarcity where the people's, even if their water supply are available, can't afford to pump it. It's estimated that by 2025, about half of the population, 3.5 billion people, will be living in water-scarce basins, and about 2.4 billion people will live in highly water-stressed basins. According to this diagram, the United States is in good shape, but again, if we get a little closer, we can look at this figure, which represents U.S. drought conditions in October of 2007. Purpose here is to also emphasize that we might expect water scarcity problems in the West and in the arid and semi-arid regions, but we also get them in areas where populations are expanding rapidly. And these can be exacerbated by severe droughts, such as we've been in the last couple of years in the southeastern United States. I think these water scarcity problems promise to keep the courts busy for years and years to come. Here's how we use water today. We withdraw approximately 400 billion gallons of water a day, about 85% of which is fresh water. And these, according to USGS, I think these data are for 2002. They haven't changed much over the last several years. The biggest users of the water that we withdraw are those consumed in for thermoelectric power generation and irrigation. And on a freshwater basis, power generation and irrigation consume about 40% each of the freshwater demands. Public supplies, you can include also domestic, only represent about 12%. These trends, these percentages may change as water demands increase and populations continue to increase. For instance, I would expect that ag will probably lose out to public water demands. And further, these trends are probably unsustainable because, as you know, a lot of the groundwater that's being used for freshwater supplies is being mined at rates that far exceed their recharge rates. So, what can we do? Well, we can conserve. You can take shorter showers. You can recycle that towel instead of having it laundered every day. You can fix leaks, not only in your home system, but in the municipal systems. Those leaks have been estimated to account for upwards of 15% of the freshwater use in domestic systems. Estimates of what we could save conserving are upwards of 30% of the in-home water use, which is certainly substantial. But remember, the domestic water use has only represented about 12% of the total withdrawal. Certainly, we can reuse our water multiple times. Obviously, we've been doing this for eons. But the point is that there's an attitude among a lot of the public that once contaminated, always contaminated. And so there's a lot of resistance to reusing water. The thing we want to talk about is substituting degraded waters for freshwater supplies. And degraded water for purposes today will be water of lower chemical, physical, and microbiological quality before its use, whether it's cleaned up ultimately or not. For our purposes, if it's once degraded, it's degraded. And examples then will be municipal wastewater effluents, animal operation effluents, storm waters, and gray water. Purpose of this symposium that you've devoted the day to, I hope, is to address the environmental impact and the sustainability of degraded water reuse. And our appointed task was to identify various degraded water sources, to provide examples of the reuse, emphasizing land-based reuse systems, identifying limitations to the reuse, and then suggest some research needs. So let's begin by talking about some of the sources. One of the first big gorillas on water use was thermoelectric power generation. Recall 40% of the total freshwater withdrawals. Much of the water that's used, is shown here in a cooling type of situation, is one-time pass-through water. It's used, it's cooled down, and it's discharged. There are some systems that recycle, but sometimes, aside from just being heated up, the water also has biosolids or other chemicals added to it that can degrade its quality. But mostly it's simply cooled and discharged back to the stream, or about a third of the water goes back into the ocean because it was saline water to begin with. There's irrigation return flow. This is a busy diagram, but those of us over 50 will remember the figure that I've shown here, and it represents all the various inflows and exchanges between irrigated areas and stream flow, and you will clearly see tailwater and deep percolation is as defined as irrigation return flow. It's been estimated that about 30% of the water that's initially used for irrigation can appear as irrigation return flow. So this is a substantial amount of water. And it's degraded by the common things that we're typically used to, salinity, sodicity, etc. And it will be, its reuse will be discussed by Lynn Dudley this afternoon. CAFOs represent only about 1% of the withdrawals, but can be very important on a local basis. The degradation here is again by salinity, sodicity, some specific ions, but now we also bring in important issues associated with pathogens and veterinary chemicals, natural synthetic hormones, etc. And Scott Bradford will be talking about these when I finish. There are municipal wastewater effluents, which are represent about 10% of the withdrawals and are used in some populated states, notably Florida and California, in a big way. We use about 50% of our effluents in the state of Florida. And the use is growing nationwide at about 15% per year. Again, you have some of the same concerns as with the CAFO effluents, despite the fact that the vast majority of municipal effluents are treated to a much higher quality than any of the other degraded waters. Our stormwater runoff, obviously the volumes vary with the precipitation patterns, but the point here is that with increased population, you get increased urbanization, you start converting natural watersheds into sealed watersheds that shed water, particularly during heavy rainstorms that result in these fuzzy pictures. Tim Fletcher has written a nice review article that will appear in the collection of published papers from this symposium. Unfortunately, he couldn't be with us to make an oral presentation. Industrial effluents, these are again, relatively small, but locally very important, and you'll hear a couple of examples of those today. They're notable often by the problems that they cause rather than their potential for reuse, potentially very high BODs, soluble salts, sometimes nutrients, a variety of organic residues, including some nasties that people often worry about, and these typically require highly specialized treatment before reuse. Gray water, spelt with an A or an E, depending on, I guess, where you live, can represent 50% of the in-home domestic use, typically from dishwashers and showers, sometimes from washing machines. And again, salinity, sodicity, nutrient, trace organics, and pathogens can be of concern. The use is very heavily in urban settings, and there are a few state guidelines, but not many. And the again, it'll be urban landscapes, either in special soil box planters or for irrigation. Fortunately, there are some excellent, very recent documents that can help you get up to speed on this. 2007, Metcalf and Eddy published a book on water reuse. Both that text, and it is a serious text, along with the 2004 guidelines put out by EPA, deal primarily with municipal water effluents, but the principles, the guidelines are generic and are an excellent place to start. And the World Health Organization in 2006 published a three-volume treatise on the safe use of wastewater, excreta, and gray water. The regulations that exist, or more often guidelines, vary depending on, obviously, on the type of reuse. The less stringent regulations apply to those where there's expected to be less contact with humans, less risk, if you will, increasing upwards until you get into unrestricted urban uses and unrestricted recreation, ag use on food chain crops, and then finally with direct potable reuse. We summarize the, and I emphasize this, the soil-based reuse issues and constraints here for you for four of the major categories of reuse: ag, urban, irrigation, environmental uses, and aquifer recharge, given a number of applications, and then identified the major issues and constraints. And I've highlighted for you the fact that public health concerns are prominent, as you might expect, certainly environmental impacts, and nutrients and salinity, et cetera, are wrapped up in all of these. So let's talk about some of these constraints. The first would be salinity. Fortunately, the limitations that are associated with salinity are well known in terms of electrical conductivity and SAR and leaching fractions, specific ions, even concern over residual chlorine. What can be interesting is when we move from traditional irrigated ag type of scenarios to reuse scenarios, we might be talking, might have to concern ourselves with some unique water quality concerns, such as increased soluble organic carbon contents and an innocent-looking phrase, micro-constituents, also referred to as toxic organics and a variety of other things. Also of need for concern is the fact that rather than talking about irrigated wheat or corn or alfalfa, now we're often talking about urban plants and the data ornamentals. And the database simply isn't as extensive with those as it is with the arable crops. Further, the application methods often are something like drip or subsurface as opposed to traditional sprinkler or furrow irrigation. Nutrients, as with many wastes, the two biggies here are nitrogen and phosphorus, and usually we focus first on nitrogen concerns, and we have, as with again, with many wastes, uncertainty in estimating the plant available nitrogen from the total nitrogen in the waste. And if we base our application rates on nitrogen, we often wind up over-applying phosphorus, which means we need to consider nutrient management plans, which lead us to P indices, but very few of the P indices that are available right now specifically address effluent phosphorus. Pathogens, first in wastewater, municipal wastewater effluents, The allowed levels are based on the likely contact with humans. Wastewater treatment plants are very used to treating to remove pathogens, and most of the regulations or guidelines are based on fecal coliforms as what we hope will be reliable indicators of pathogen hazard. Thought you might be interested in some slight variations in reference values. The World Health Organization says as long as you have less than 1,000 fecal coliform per 100 mils, you can use that water for irrigation on crops eaten raw. Whereas in the United States, for unrestricted use, the guidelines are a bit lower, anywhere from zero to, I think the max is 200 per 100 mil. Pathogens and animal effluents tend, in my mind, tend to be a bigger problem. And the reason is, in many cases, there's little or no treatment for these effluents. They might go into a lagoon and be held there for a while, but then they go straight out, and so there's much greater opportunity for human or animal risk. And we can be concerned about so-called emerging pathogens in a variety of categories, bacteria, viruses, and parasites. And some of these have tremendous notoriety and serious human and economic impact. If you're familiar with the latest spinach situation, you appreciate the comment here. There are also emerging chemicals of concern. In most cases, this focuses on pharmaceuticals and personal care products, but it also includes a variety of veterinary drugs, feed additives, even some materials that we hadn't worried about, not necessarily the individual pesticides, but adjuvants that are associated with that, maybe some chemicals in soil amendments. And they all have a way, either atmospherically, through solids addition, through irrigation, and getting into the soil plant system. They can run off, contaminate surface water, they can infiltrate, contaminate groundwater, they can contaminate our food supply. Truly an area of major concern. By the way, this Pedersen paper is excellent if you get an opportunity to read it. Associated with these issues on emerging chemicals is the fact that most of the notoriety and the research that's been done has been on aquatic species. There's been much less work done on the impacts when those chemicals get into the soil. But the impacts are potentially enormous. Everything from increased antibiotic resistance, endocrine disruption, ecological effects, feminization of frogs, etc., immune system effects, and the biggie, the unknown long-term chronic effects, perhaps synergistic effects of multiple chemicals. A major limitation to water reuse, I think, is public acceptance. You might guess that the willingness of public to allow water to be reused depends on the water type and the source, how you're going to reuse it. But there are also these cultural and local issues which can be dramatic. For instance, Tim Fletcher relates a survey in his written paper in which the citizenry was asked, of the various kinds of degraded waters, which one would you prefer to be reused? Well, we are comfortable with reusing stormwater much more so than we are this wastewater effluents. And if you're going to use those wastewater effluents, we just as soon you put it in concrete, then try to use it for crop irrigation and certainly direct potable use. Stakeholder buy-in is absolutely critical to the success of any reuse program. Lots of municipalities have learned this the hard way. Sounds sort of redundant to the issue on biosolids and a lot of other wastes that we're trying to reuse on the soil. Regulations can be a major limitation. Actually, it's the lack of regulations. It may or may not surprise you that there are no federal regulations that directly govern effluent use. There may be guidelines, but there are no federal regulations. In fact, many states Some states have actually regulations. Again, most have guidelines. But what happens is that situations are considered on a case-by-case basis. This results in slow movement forward of projects, and I would suggest fosters the wrong perception. We're really dealing here with something that's dangerous, and we need to be very, very careful. Maybe what we need for effluent degraded waters are federal guidelines similar to the 40 CFR Part 503 regulations for biosolids. I'm sure we have some senior EPA people in the audience who would volunteer to be part of the team that came up with those guidelines. The future of degraded water reuse is a must. It will increase whether we like it or not. It simply must. We don't have enough water to meet the growing demands. I believe it is sustainable if we can get public acceptance, if we can come up with stricter and federally based discharge requirements, if we can take advantage of numerous innovative technologies for treating that water before we reuse it, and we can get political support. And this is a toughie. We're going to need hard science-based educational efforts to educate politicians. So what are the issues that relate to us as soil scientists? Arbitrarily divided these into one category called traditional, where we have the most experience, salinity, sodicity, that kind of thing. Pretty straightforward kind of stuff. A little less traditional is when we have to start worrying about soluble organic carbons, facilitated transport of things, not the purview of the older generation, perhaps. Importantly, is the need to develop reliable indicator organisms for risk assessment, particularly in densely populated urban settings, because this is where the water is probably going to be used. And then the traditional paradigm-shifting issues, I think it's the emerging chemicals and pathogens. Mostly, it's paradigm shifting because there can be no bucket chemists like me. You're going to have tremendously enhanced analytical capabilities because the concentrations of concern are much lower than what we're used to dealing with, and we typically have complex matrices. If we don't have that expertise, we have to team with people who do have that expertise, and they need teaming. We need validated fate and transport models. That's an old issue. The point is there are models that are out there based on QSAR-type models, based on structural features of molecules, theoretical models that are being used to run ahead with the estimates of risk and degradation, et cetera. To my knowledge, none has been validated. And the models are primarily by people who are using clean systems, not soil-based systems. We have to be involved with those people. If we're able to get the models and the data, then maybe we can do the risk assessment, but it's going to be a major challenge. We can't just count on low concentrations being so low as to not be a bother, because the kinds of impacts that we're talking about occur at extremely low concentrations. And we're going to need reliable surrogate organisms to complete that pathway analysis, probably much more sophisticated than just fecal coliforms. So what are the major hurdles to reuse? Public and political acceptance. It's meant to be at the top of the list. And we must educate them. And we must get ahead of the curve, if at all possible, with hard science educational efforts to counter misconceptions. I had hysteria in here in the first place, but my co-authors convinced me to replace that word. We must be committed to reinventing ourselves in our science. Again, we're going to be moving into using some of the same principles that we're used to, but in very different settings, and we have to be willing either to change ourselves or to team with people who are used to using these things. But we must get this right. Water demands are tremendous. They are going to be increasing. We will have to use, reuse degraded water. And we are the people to do this, if we can commit it. Thank you for your attention.
We have time for a few questions.
Yes, ma'am. Let me try to paraphrase. Is there opportunity for degraded water reuse if we change the way we create energy instead of coal?
I think more just the consumption, not reuse, but, you know, the consumption in power generation. So, are they developing certain new energy technologies that are going to create?
I would expect that there would certainly be some opportunity there, methane generation through anaerobic digestion of various kinds of wastes, and so that you're not having this excess heat associated with coal burning, for instance, or nuclear. Yes, I suspect there's some potential impact there. I would guess that the vast majority is still going to be heat producing type of energy production. Yes, Ian.
Kind of a related question. Do you have any comments on the relationship directly between water and energy and energy and water? And then secondly, the issue of, with water reuse, treating water appropriately depending upon the target for the reuse, because that's where things are going to be.
I either don't understand or I am too ignorant to respond to the first question on the energy, water, energy.
We can generate 100% pure water that's perfectly safe for anyone to drink. It takes a tremendous amount of energy. So the strategy should be minimizing energy inputs and treating water to the level that we need for the target. So for example, toilet flushing as opposed to potable.
Then using natural systems to effect the final cleaning step as opposed to doing it artificially. Yes, indeed.
Any other questions?
Yes, sir.
So the waste is a wastewater treatment
plant. I beg your pardon?
So if we reuse the gray water?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Of course. Part of the success of the fact that we have been reused, the secret is that we've been reusing degraded water for eons, okay? And what gets flushed upstream does become your drinking water, okay? Don't tell anybody. And part of the success is that water is withdrawn and put through a very effective drinking water treatment plant. So I would prefer to continue to call it drinking water treatment plant as opposed to degraded water or wastewater drinking plant.
Time for one last question.
George, you mentioned the analytical numbers to go down. And, you know, 10 to the minus 24 molar is one molecule per liter. It's a yoke per molar. So we're not even close to getting to protection limits. So I would say that we probably got to do with this that we haven't done this sort of things is use biosensors or link it, these concentrations to some floor of the falling detection limits. So instead of just an analytical chemistry approach, we switch gears. Can you comment? Is anybody doing something like that?
Yes, indeed. Biosensors are used for water testing. certainly, I guess my point maybe was too well disguised. I believe that we need to team up with the people who are capable of these incredible analytical detection limits, et cetera, to try to bring them more to realistic interpretations of their numbers. And I have no trouble with assays. The problem has always been with bioassays, the specificity, and to making sure that what you're measuring in a response is due to the chemical that you think it's due to.